chaotic though the events of our world appear to be, unpredictable as the future has proven to be, Jesus' assurances that time is taking us resolutely to the hoped-for reign of God's peace doesn't have to be taken as simple speculation. Perhaps faithful eyes can see the patterns that are taking us there.
That's the Reverend Dr. Bob Baggett, and today he brings you a powerful message of faith entitled Apocalypse Not Now. I'm Peter Wallace, and this is Day One.
Welcome to Day One, the weekly program that brings you outstanding preachers from America's historic Protestant churches, sharing insight and inspiration from God's Word for your life. Now, here's our host, Peter Wallace, to introduce today's preacher.
Thank you, Sherry. Today on Day One, we're honored to welcome the Reverend Dr. Robert T. Baggett III, Senior Minister of the Community Church of Vero Beach, Florida, a United Church of Christ congregation. Bob earned a bachelor's degree from Samford University, a Master of Divinity degree from New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary, and a Doctor of Ministry degree from Graduate Theological Foundation in South Bend, Indiana. Prior to accepting the call to Vero Beach in 2004, where he serves with his wife, Casey, he served churches in Atlanta, Miami, and Minneapolis. Bob, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Peter. Glad to be here.
Your wife and fellow minister at Community Church, Casey, was with us a couple of weeks ago. So what's your elevator speech about the church you serve?
The elevator speech is this. It's about a mile and a half from the ocean, and it's a great place to see God because all the waves that come in, they ultimately go out, but they all come back again. And it's kind of like the Spirit of Christ. It just keeps coming to us.
What particular aspects of your ministry there do you enjoy most?
I enjoy ministering in Florida because you don't find many people from Florida.
Yeah.
You know, people come to Florida from somewhere else, and they come with these grand hopes and dreams of one thing or the other. And the church becomes a place where they can mix with other people and find a rootedness in their life that they left in New England or in the Midwest. And so the church is—it's not a clearinghouse; it's a way station for their dreams, and we help to bring them together in a community. I like that kind of ministry, and I think Florida offers you that. The country.
There's a seasonal aspect to the ministry there, as you have some snowbird members. How does that affect the flow of church life, and how do you deal with that?
Well, it is a national church, as we call it. I mean, we have members all over the country. Our online ministry is very large, our live streaming as well as streaming of worship services. And it affects it in size, where during the season we'll, you know, 1,200, 1,500 in worship, and in the summer you can get down in the 450, 500. I mean, by the end of the summer, you start feeling like the church is not doing very well. But then all of a sudden, somebody turns a switch or a cold front hits New England, and things are wonderful again. It affects it also with boards and committees. Mm-hmm. We now are working hard to utilize conference calling a lot more and having to learn what that means, what it means for people of faith, not to be in a room, to feel the community in the room, but to hear the voice. So we're working with technology to hopefully allow our people to stay engaged in the life of the church, even if they're in some other part of the country.
You serve on several boards, both in the community and religious organizations of one kind or another. What sorts of organizations interest you most in terms of serving in this way?
You know, I have to admit, Peter, that just within the last couple of years, I've found that I am being drawn more and more to interfaith conversations, interfaith interactions, than I am to ecumenical. I don't know what that's about. That may be that this ecumenical, we've been beating our heads against the wall. It's so difficult, and we have great days and we have not so great days. And I think all of us in some ways, and at least in the Christian community, want to be a part of that. But I found this interfaith dialogue to be much more, and this is an odd word to use, I think, but much more innocent because we come into a room and we're kind of afraid of one another. And so you go very slowly in learning about those very small things that mean a lot to us. And as I look at the world and what's going on in the world, you know, I think for us, at least in our church, I think this really gives us an opportunity to interact with the world.
Well, this Sunday, the church begins the season of Advent and a new liturgical year begins. How would you describe what is happening during the season leading up to the birth of Christ?
Well, as I look at this leading up to the birth of Christ for the early church, I suspect, and this is my own, you know, my own understanding of it, that these early Christians are getting a lot of pressure from those who have not embraced the way, the Christian mm-hmm. journey yet, that this Jesus who they say is going to bring the kingdom and this God who's going to restore this grand kingdom hasn't come yet.
Mm-hmm.
They're finding it hard, I think, some of them, to stay committed to this.
Mm-hmm.
Not that they've been sold a bill of goods, I'm not saying that, because their lives have been changed, radically altered, but this kingdom's supposed to come. And so they look outside and they see the kingdom not necessarily there for other people.
Mm-hmm.
They may be mm-hmm. practicing it in their small house churches, but when they get outside that in the streets, Rome's still very much alive and in power, and the world is not there yet. And so I see it as a season of tension
mm-hmm.
between hope and despair.
Well, your sermon is based on the gospel lesson for this Sunday from Mark chapter 13. Would you read it for us?
But in those days, after that suffering, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will be falling from heaven and the powers in the heavens will be shaken. Then they will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory. Then he will send out the angels and gather his elect from the four winds, from the ends of the earth to the ends of heaven. From the fig tree, learn its lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts forth its leaves, you know that summer is near. So also, when you see these things taking place, you know that he is near, at the very gates. Truly I tell you, this generation will not pass away until all these things have taken place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. But about that day or hour no one knows. Neither the angels in heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. Beware, keep alert, for you do not know when the time will come. It is like a man going on a journey, when he leaves home and puts his slaves in charge, each with his work, and commands the doorkeeper to be on the watch. Therefore, keep awake, for you do not know when the master of the house will come, in the evening, or at midnight, or at cockcrow, or at dawn, or else he may find you asleep when he comes suddenly. And what I say to you, I say to all, keep awake.
Keep awake. Bob, we look forward to hearing your sermon, Apocalypse Not Now. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Peter. Well, today on this first Sunday of Advent, instead of angels bringing tidings with great joy to all the people, the lectionary asks us to consider the end of the world. Now, to be honest, that's a topic most preachers from my tradition would rather save for a Sunday in the middle of July when the crowds are light, the service is shorter, and we just happen to be on vacation in the mountains of Colorado with no internet or cell service for a month. But, alas, there's no hiding from it today. The end of the world will be our focus. So, what do you believe about the end of the world? How do you believe it will happen? Who will it claim? When will it be? Last year, while leading a pilgrimage group to Israel, I stood with our large band of travelers on the very spot where Armageddon, the cataclysmic end of the world, is supposed to take place, according to the biblical book of Revelation. The place is called Megiddo, the word from which the biblical word Armageddon is derived. At Megiddo, we are told, a cosmic battle between good and evil will end it all. Well, Megiddo is a fascinating archaeological site, as well as a haunting and mysterious place, especially given the biblical prophecy assigned to it. But I have to admit that I found it somewhat comforting to note that there was a McDonald's restaurant just around the corner from Megiddo, and furthermore, that particular McDonald's restaurant was being expanded to accommodate a new drive-in window, which said to me that, at least for now, there's definitely a healthy future anticipated for Megiddo. For after all, can a business that has sold over 99 billion hamburgers be wrong? Truth is, there have been many who have made predictions about the end of the world, and they've been wrong.
In 1665, as the plague ravaged London, a man named Solomon Eccles was jailed for disturbing the peace by striding through Smithfield Market stark naked, carrying a pan of blazing coals on his head, prophesying doom and destruction for the world. But the world did not end in 1665. Around 1830, Reverend William Miller began predicting that between 1843 and 1844, Christ would return to earth and purify it by fire. Many of his followers gave away all their possessions in anticipation of the end, but 1844 came and went without incident. In succeeding decades, Miller's followers would go on to form the Seventh-day Adventist movement, but the world did not end. In 1970, American evangelist Hal Lindsey wrote his first book, the bestseller, The Late Great Planet Earth, a book in which he attempted to correlate certain world events with biblical prophecies in order to predict Armageddon and the second coming of Christ. In a later book, The 1980s, Countdown to Armageddon, he stated that the decade of the 1980s could very well be the last decade of history as we know it. The 1980s have come and gone, and the world did not end. Between 1995 and 2007, authors Tim LaHaye and Jerry Jenkins authored 16 widely popular novels about the apocalypse, garnering support and praise from some Christians and criticism from others. In fact, HBO's filmed a series called The Leftovers that follows events on Earth after 2% of the population simultaneously and mysteriously disappears in what may or may not have been a rapture event prefiguring the end of time. The end of time. Yes, theologians and historians have predicted it. Countless songs have explored its themes. Hieronymus Bosch painted it. T.S. Eliot poetically declared it would come not with a bang, but with a whimper. Yes, there have been so many visions of the end. Because, well, it seems that across the centuries, we humans have urgently wanted to get a look at the last page, to know when and how the last scene of this whole human adventure will take place. And the followers of Jesus were no different. They, too, wanted to know when the end of the world would come, when time would be no more. Wanting to know not out of some gloomy, death-seeking fatalism, but because they anticipated that the end of the world would bring God's judgment and mercy and usher in the reign of God's peace. But as we hear in this text, Jesus steadfastly resists giving any kind of timetable for that hoped-for end, which, I think, may be why the lectionary has directed us to this text on the first Sunday of Advent. After all, Advent is about waiting and hoping for something we could not precisely predict, but which we know God eventually brought about in the birth of Christ. Surely, then, God may also be relied upon to bring about a conclusion of history in a manner and timing we may trust. So, what particulars does Jesus have to offer his disciples about the end of the world? Well, if you notice, he offers none of the fearsome specifics some modern authors and preachers have provided us. Instead, Jesus simply offers us a few assurances. First, he says, about that day or hour, no one knows. Neither the angels in heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. Or, to put it another way, Jesus says the future is definitely not ours to know. Yes, we can calculate. We can try, I guess, to correlate curtain day events with prophecies and predictions. But for all that, the truth is we're no wiser or closer to the truth. Because no one knows but God what our future holds. I think recent history should be proof of that. The pace of change seems to grow faster and faster and faster. I mean, think about it. There are generations alive today who remember the first automobiles and yet have lived to see a man walk on the moon, which they watched on a television and can now see reported through a computer or on a cell phone or any other of their mobile devices. So who really knows what tomorrow will bring? Perhaps something beyond our wildest dreams. We don't know, and yet, far from being a discouraging aspect of life,
Our inability to know the future should be an encouragement to us, I think. How should it be an encouragement? Well, not knowing what lies ahead shields us now from some of the hardships we might one day have to face. Not knowing the future actually encourages us to invest ourselves, our gifts, our talents, our resources to influence the momentum of history. So no, we cannot know where the sweep of history is pushing, nor when it will reach its end point. Only God knows the future. Therefore, Jesus says, making his second point about the end of the world, keep alert, keep awake, for the master of the house is coming. In other words, though Jesus resists giving specifics on when the end will arrive, he never refutes that an end will ultimately come, that God, the Master, will return to complete God's work and fulfill God's dream for our world, bringing a reign of justice and peace. So in anticipation of this hoped-for arrival, Jesus says, stay alert. Get ready. The Master will come. And you know, I happen to think that chaotic though the events of our world appear to be, unpredictable as the future has proven to be, Jesus' assurances that time is taking us resolutely to the hoped-for reign of God's peace doesn't have to be taken as simple speculation. In fact, perhaps, faithful eyes can see the patterns that are taking us there. For example, do you know the term chaology? Chaology is the study of chaos theories and has spawned many interesting speculations about the randomness of events. Famously, some have suspected that a butterfly flapping its wings in Brazil might set off a cascade of events that result in a tornado in Texas. But while that notion is highly unlikely, the butterfly effect, as it is called, can nevertheless help us to understand the unpredictability of things in general. For example, if millions of little events, all as seemingly insignificant as the trajectory of a butterfly's flight, all offer their slight influence on a system, it's virtually impossible to predict the outcome. Scientists claim that's why it is so difficult to accurately predict the weather for more than a few days in advance, because there are just too many variables. And yet, according to computer models, there are patterns even to the chaos of all of life. You and I can't discern them any more than a fish can analyze the water in which it swims. But there are patterns, patterns even to chaos. Now, I know that may sound paradoxical, patterns within chaos. But listen to this. Are you familiar with random number generators? Random number generators are tiny boxes that produce a steady stream of random numbers, limited to zeros or ones, all the time. Every second, the constant stream of numbers is sent for analysis to a large computer. And when a purely random stream of numbers occurs, there's a flat-line graph that results. Such random number generators are in research facilities all over the world, which cooperate in their research. Interestingly, scientists now know that sometimes patterns emerge within the apparent randomness and wildly fluctuating graphs are made. Such a pattern occurred on September 11, 2001. For a few hours before the planes hit New York City's Twin Towers, and for a few days afterward, discernible patterns appeared as tracked by computers in 41 countries around the world. The machines went out of sync to the extreme. Why, it was as if the whole cosmos was shuddering in pain together over what happened that day in New York City. The same thing happened the day Princess Diana died. The same thing happened the day the tsunami hit in Asia. So, as people of faith, we should not perhaps be surprised to find that randomness and chaos are tentative, that patterns and momentum and purpose invariably emerge, because history is not a blind force. For in ways we cannot perfectly understand, and with a timing we can't predict, the Master is always at work. Or to put it another way, we see God's hand guiding, nudging, enabling the actors on the world stage to move towards God's envisioned end. Yes,
God's power and purpose is at work in the world. It makes for a subtle but discernible pattern. I mean, could we say we see God's power and purpose at work in this world behind the discovery of a vaccine that eradicated polio? Could we say we see God's power and purpose at work in this world at the toppling of Hitler's horrific Third Reich? The discovery and mapping of the human genome sequence? The advancement in cancer research? Yes, behind the universe is a power that steadily guides and heals and leads us towards God's goal that will be reached inevitably, despite the setbacks and hardships that dot history. Jesus advises that we stay awake, watching and waiting for these things, watching and waiting for how God is working and how God will next come to us. Which leads to a third point Jesus seems to be making about the end of the world. God is like a master who goes on a journey and leaves the servants in charge, he says. We're in charge. We're in charge, each with our work to do on the master's behalf. Worrying about exactly when the master will return could be paralyzing, or at least distracting enough to keep us from offering our best efforts. And so it seems we're called simply to go on with our lives, living confidently, as capably and productively as we can, setting our minds and hearts on helping God further the work of His creation and doing Christ's work in this world. Yes, Jesus here seems to be teaching us something about time management. Not only is the past over and out of our reach, but the future is as well. The future is not ours to grasp, at least not yet. Our task then is not to harbor regret or obsess about the future, but to live in concert with the patterns and powers of God's presence among us right now. For God only knows when the end will actually come. Now I know that's not exactly bumper sticker stuff, is it? I mean, it's not as good as a bumper sticker that might read, "In case of rapture, this car will be empty," or another that might read, "Are you ready for Jesus' return?" But it does have biblical integrity, I think, to simply say, keep awake. The time we await will come. Yes, Jesus' words here in Mark's gospel on the subject of the world's end, they're not meant to be frightening. They were, I'm convinced, words offered to his followers that were intended to free them from fretting about details they could not know, and taking comfort instead in noting the patterns of God's eternal care for us that will stretch on to eternity. And with that firm assurance comes the freedom to live now, fully. One of my favorite films of all time is the great epic Ben-Hur. Perhaps it's because of the epic chariot race. When filming Ben-Hur, an enormous set was constructed for this very special race, and then teams of stuntmen were trained to drive four-horse chariots for the race sequence. Charlton Heston, the star of the film, was among the first to arrive for training and was quick to grasp chariot driving techniques. Nevertheless, Charlton Heston was concerned that in the actual filming of the race, he might not be able to pull off a victory. And so he went to the director and he shared his concerns, and the director responded to Charlton Heston, "Charlton, you just stay in the chariot, and I'll guarantee you win the race." You know, maybe those aren't far from the words that God might wish to say to us during these disconcerting days of terrorism and wars and gaping societal wounds, all of which make the world a fearful place and bring us to wonder just what will happen next. It's not for us to know. Only God, Jesus reminds us, knows the future. But don't worry. If we just stay in the race, God will make sure we win. And that is our Advent hope, you see. It is a hope that as followers of Christ, we need not adopt a worldview that presumes eventual destruction, no real possibilities, no possibility of redemption, no. Jesus grants us a very different worldview to his followers in chapter 13 of Mark's gospel. Of you predicted, I have heard it said, on these certainties. Where there is hope in the heart of a person, there is the presence of God. Where there is God, there is love. Where there is love, all shall be well. So on this first Sunday of Advent, take heart, for our God, the God of love, is in ultimate control. And that, my friends, is a truth you can safely believe. Amen.
The Reverend Dr. Robert T. Baggett was our preacher today. Bob is senior minister of Community Church of Vero Beach, Florida, a United Church of Christ congregation. For a free transcript of his message for the first Sunday of Advent entitled Apocalypse, Not Now, call us toll-free at 1-888-411-DAY1. That's 888-411-3291. I'm Sherry Miller. Next time on Day One, we're delighted to have with us the Reverend Dr. Michael Brown, senior minister of Marble Collegiate Church in New York, New York. His sermon for the second Sunday of Advent is entitled, God at Our Doorsteps. You won't want to miss it. Day One is making a difference in people's lives day by day. Please consider making a year-end donation so we can continue to inspire you and countless others across America and around the world. Mail your gift to Day One, 2715 Peachtree Road, Atlanta, Georgia 30305, or call us at 1-888-411-DAY1, or give securely online at dayone.org. Thank you, and God bless you. Now, Bob Baggett offers some final reflections on his sermon today with our host, Peter Wallace.
Bob, the season of Advent begins with a bang. We focus on the end of the world as Jesus talks about it in Mark chapter 13. Jesus' followers were no different than many of us. They wanted to know when the end would come, hoping for God's judgment and mercy and eternal reign. But Jesus won't say when. In fact, as you put it, he steadfastly resists giving any kind of timetable for this hoped-for event. So we wait and hope for this grand climax of history just as we wait for the coming of the Messiah in the season of Advent. How does Advent help us to do that waiting and hoping?
Well, I think for me, Advent does be, you know, as it's supposed to be, it's a time of preparation to prepare ourselves for the coming of Christ into the world and God's power into the world. And Advent forces us or asks us to do certain things to prepare ourselves, to be more aware, to be more in touch with who we are, to what the voices are telling us from outside our lives. You know, the Mary event of the angels coming and the shepherds hearing singing. And, you know, what are we listening to? What are we seeing in this world? And I think it's a pausing time for us, interestingly enough, paradoxically enough, to be active in our spiritual lives and to know that at the end of this Advent time, what the story tells us is that Christ will come. And there will be this moment when we as a community and we as a faithful people will be able to celebrate that coming to earth.
You said our inability to know the future should be an encouragement to us because not knowing our future shields us from some hardships we might have to face, but it also encourages us to invest ourselves, our gifts, talents, and resources to influence the momentum of history. Would you say more about why that is?
Well, I think if we knew what the future held for us personally, then we might begin to make decisions based upon what that is and when that happens. Mm-hmm. And therefore, it becomes our own sense of will. Mm. Where if we don't know when that ends and we don't know what will happen, we're still dependent upon those things that are coming to us to try and understand them and attempt to say, what does this mean for me? How then shall I live? And it takes away the entrepreneurial spirit, if you will, of trying to listen to God, learning as best you can how God leads you. And it also takes away failing at things because we would not ever risk it. And I don't know about you, but so much of what I've learned in this life has been through the great failures, not through the successes. And so you take those failures out of the way because I'm not going to risk that, then you're really cutting yourself off from learning about the life of faith and about the depth and breadth of what the world is. So it keeps us nimble. It keeps us open. It keeps us willing to risk. It keeps us alive. And then finally, for me, it keeps us trusting. I don't know when it's going to end. I don't know what's going to happen. I do know this. I have trust that God's in charge of that. And that just as I was brought into this world in love, that I then will go out of this world and love. And what else could we ask of a world of hatred and violence that we see, to know that we come in love and go out in love?
Bob, what's one thing from your sermon today that you hope our listeners will keep in mind in the days ahead?
Keep on keeping on. Don't allow the voices that are paid to be articulate in our ear to try to manipulate us and turn us from the things that are good and right and just. Keep on keeping on what you feel in the center of your calling to be a person of Christ and model that. Because I think it will be rewarded in so many different ways by God. And I don't talk about personal reward. I mean to the world itself. Just like we talked about the random number generators. I mean, what happens if we send out a sense of goodness instead of anguish to the world? Will the world feel that? Will there be a response to that? I don't want us to give up. I don't want us to feel paralyzed. I think we have to continue to work towards the good.
Bob Baggett, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Peter. It's great to be here.
Day One is the voice of America's mainline Protestant churches. Visit us online at dayone.org. Our program is recorded and edited by Donald Jones and produced by Peter Wallace. Thank you for joining us. I'm Sherry Miller, wishing you all God's blessings on Day One and forever.